Good morning. Time now for the regular roundup of war news with reports from far corners of the world. Our foreign correspondents are standing by, ready with direct coverage of the latest developments. First, we take you to Melbourne, Australia. Come in, Melbourne.
This is Martin Agronsky calling from Melbourne. I'm reliably informed that General MacArthur's estimate of the Pacific situation, together with his recommendations concerning both strategy and personnel, is now being studied in London and Washington. Meanwhile, at American Army headquarters, the job of reorganizing and unifying the Allied High Command is being pushed at top speed under MacArthur's personal direction. Since 7 o'clock this morning, MacArthur has been hard at work in his personal headquarters, trying to catch up on the massive paperwork that has accumulated in the course of his trip here from the Philippines. Throughout the day, the general remained in his quarters, not leaving them once, even to attend the American General Staff Conference held at American Army headquarters in another part of the city. According to one of the officers on his staff, MacArthur seems entirely recovered from his strenuous and nerve-wracking voyage, and as this officer put it, full of beans. When one of his officers suggested that he take time out to stroll outside for a few minutes in the brilliant Australian sunshine, MacArthur replied that he had all the exercise he needed in pacing up and down his room, and that he would get all the sunshine he needed when he took the field against the Japs with a perfected plan of campaign in his pocket. Late this afternoon, U.S. Admiral Leary, Naval Chief of the Anzac area, and U.S. Lieutenant General Brett, Air Force Commander in the Anzac area, visited MacArthur separately for long conferences. They were preceded by Australian Army, Navy, and Air Force chiefs, and there seems little doubt that MacArthur's pet idea of a completely unified high command, embracing Army, Navy, and Air Force personnel under a central direction, is the goal toward which the general is now working. I learned authoritatively from Canberra that parallel with General MacArthur's reorganization, the Australian General Staff is in the midst of a thoroughgoing house cleaning. Some of the highest-ranking officers in the Australian Army and Air Force will be affected by the shakeup now underway. I am informed that Prime Minister Curtin will soon announce Army and Air Force changes that will bring many young and comparatively junior Australian officers to positions of real authority. There will be no change, however, in the decision taken some time ago to appoint General Blamey, Commander-in-Chief of the Australian Forces in the Middle East, as General Officer commanding Australian Field Forces in the Anzac area. While MacArthur and the Australians are moving as fast as they can to iron out the organizational kinks in the Allied armies, the Japs are moving as fast as they can to hit hard at Australia before the Allied plan of campaign goes into full operation. The Japs have not yet struck with any considerable aerial force at any point on Australia's northern coast or even in New Guinea, but the increasing regularity with which the Japs are raiding Darwin and Broome in the north and Port Moresby in New Guinea is thought here to indicate a large-scale Jap attack on those areas in the near future. Throughout the Pacific campaign, the Jap technique has been to raid points marked down for invasion with light forces at first, then with increasingly heavy forces, and finally with large-scale forces which are followed by invasion units. Though American flying fortresses and Australian bombers are hammering steadily and effectively at Jap shipping concentrations in the waters off New Guinea and the northern Australian coast, the Japs still seem able to produce two ships for every one sunk. At the moment, Java seems to be the rallying point for Jap transports earmarked for the attack on Australia, and a constant stream of heavily guarded troop and supply ships moves steadily each day from the Dutch East Indies to the Jap concentration points at Rabaul, Ley, and Salamoa in New Guinea. The Jap invasion attempt, when it comes, is expected to be directed at some point along Australia's northern coast, probably the tiny pearling town of Broome in the northwest, or some point between Cape York and Darwin further to the east. And here's a bulletin just issued a few minutes ago by the Australian Air Force. Australian bombers raided the aerodrome at Ley this morning, leaving 3 Jap bombers and 9 fighters burning on the ground, with another 2 Jap bombers and 3 fighters damaged. Jap troops and airmen on the ground were machine gunned by the Australian raiders. One of 3 Jap fighters attempting to intercept the Australian bombers was shot down, though 2 Australian crewmen were wounded. The Japs again raided Darwin this morning, and for the first time, attacked an inland town at Catherine, southeast of Darwin. Jap reconnaissance over Papua was continued today. Two Australian aircraft failed to return from operations in the Anzac area. This is Mark Nagronsky returning you now to San Francisco.
And now across the nation to our newsroom in New York.
For another on-the-spot report, we turn now to London and John McVain.
This is London. London heard from Burma today that Chinese and British troops have had successful engagements with the Japanese in the Irrawaddy and Sitang areas, but that they haven't been followed by any general action. It's officially stated that the situation on both fronts is quiet. Since Friday, 14 German planes have been shot down over Malta in some of the heaviest raids since last December. A report issued today says that anti-aircraft guns got 10 and RAF fighters 4. The British ambassador to Turkey has told the Turkish government that the bombs dropped from British aircraft were responsible for the damage caused on March 14th at Milas, a town some 20 miles inland from the coast opposite the Dodecanese. The island of Rhodes was an objective that night, and the official inquiry has shown that the accidental bombing of Milas was due to the complete darkness and bad conditions generally. The British government state that they wish to pay all necessary compensation. Last night, the British government issued the text of the Churchill Curtain cables on the appointment of Mr. Casey as British War Cabinet Minister in the Middle East. The cables show that Mr. Curtin, the Australian Premier, turned down Mr. Churchill's first suggestion. Mr. Churchill, however, insisted on the appointment and suggested to the Australian Labour Prime Minister that Mr. Menzies, former Conservative Premier, could replace Mr. Casey as Australian minister in Washington. Mr. Curtin in another cable said he wouldn't stand in the way of Mr. Churchill's desires. A cable delay seems to have resulted in the Australian government getting the first news of the actual appointment from a London broadcast. In his last cable sent yesterday, Mr. Churchill said he was publishing the text of the cables because of the extensive summaries published in Australia. Most British people know little of Mr. Casey beyond his photograph and the popular description of him is the Australian Anthony Eden. The appointment would seem to have been chiefly important as a British gesture to the Australians, but some quarters believe that from Australian reactions, the effect has been quite different from that intended. Australians here who know Mr. Curtin describe him as an extremely honest, blunt type of man. He's a member of the Federal Labour Party, and Australian observers believe that Mr. Churchill's suggestion of the key Washington job for Mr. Menzies, Mr. Curtin's chief Conservative rival, won't be very popular with the Australian government. Some observers fear that from Australian reactions that have reached here, the whole matter may be taken as touching internal Australian politics. In these past few weeks, the demand for British offense, for the establishment of a second front, has again developed in Britain. John Gordon, editor of Lord Beaverbrook's Sunday Express, says Russia needs a second front in Europe to strain the already strained and stretched German armies. He points out that for his Russian offensive, Hitler has denuded Europe of his finest fighting troops and planes. Gordon continues, "The moment Hitler launches his new attack is the moment when we must pull ourselves together with all our might to answer Stalin's call and fight. Open a second front in Europe, and you open a running wound that Hitler must make an effort to staunch, even at the cost of weakening his blow at Russia." This is John McVain in London, returning you to New York.
Back in New York now, here's a report from Russia. Moscow. The long Russian front this morning is erupting in a series of bloody battles. Some observers say that upon the outcome of these engagements hangs the fate of Hitler's Russian campaign. And southward from Leningrad to the shores of the Sea of Azov, Russian armies are battering at the vital occupied bases of the entire German line. Moscow tells of a two-day battle on the Leningrad front in which the Nazis lost 1,600 men as well as much war booty. On another sector, a Russian guard unit has killed 870 German soldiers, 5 officers and 47 non-coms. 13 guns were captured along with 10 mortars and 23 heavy machine guns. The Soviet communique also declares that in some points on the southwestern front, German forces have repeatedly launched counterattacks, but were all beaten back. In one sector alone, the Hitlerites lost 500 men. It's there on the southwest that Marshal Timoshenko's legions are driving against the Germans entrenched eastward of Dniepropetrovsk, that Nazi-occupied city is said to be Hitler's supply base for operations in the Crimea. And a brief report from Istanbul, Turkey. An informed source believes that territorial dispute between Hungary and Romania will result in the fall of the present Hungarian government. And when the Calais government goes the way of its predecessor, Hitler is expected to obtain a real Quisling leadership in Budapest. The territorial dispute already has flared close to an open break between the two Balkan partners of the Axis. In the Vienna Conference, controlled by Hitler, Romania lost a large part of Transylvania to Hungary, and she lost other territory to Bulgaria, territory which she herself had obtained at the close of the World War No. 1. And now for word on events at home, we switch to the newsroom in Washington.
Washington may soon see a full-dress investigation of the War Production Board. What started out as a House Military Affairs Subcommittee's inquiry into the charge that dollar-a-year production officials are placing their own interests above those of the government now appears likely to encompass the whole WPB structure. Representative Charles I. Faddis, Pennsylvania Democrat, who's chairman of the investigating committee, says that it's quite probable that production czar Donald Nelson will be called on to testify sometime during the week. And there are indications that Philip Reed, head of the Bureau of Industries branch of WPB, will also appear. The committee's decision to hear Nelson and Reed is the outgrowth of the recent charges by Robert R. Guthrie, former chief of WPB's textile, clothing, and leather goods branch, that production board officials are reluctant to order industry to convert to war production despite Nelson's fervent pleas for more speed. Before he resigned last week, Guthrie was assistant to Reed, and it's understood that the two men had several serious disagreements as to policy. In the meantime, more economy moves are underway on Capitol Hill. Tennessee's Senator McKellar is sponsor of a bill which would abolish both the Civilian Conservation Corps and the National Youth Administration. The senator says that his legislation is an out-and-out economy move. He discussed the bill with President Roosevelt yesterday for almost an hour. And although McKellar says the president offered some most helpful suggestions, he declines to reveal what they were. That Mr. Roosevelt does not favor the abolition of the agencies, however, seems to be borne out in a statement by his press secretary, Stephen Early. Before McKellar's conference with the chief executive, Early told newsmen that Mr. Roosevelt considers the CCC and the NYA perfectly essential wartime services. Selective Service Director Hershey has ordered the country's draft boards to be more strict in the question of occupational deferments. In a memorandum to all boards, General Hershey says that deferment for occupational reasons should be extended only to persons whose jobs are really necessary to war production or essential to the support of the war effort. At the same time, the general advised industry to employ women and physically handicapped persons or those with dependents so that an additional reservoir of manpower may be placed at the disposal of the armed services. Amplifying his statement that only those whose jobs are considered essential to the war effort should be granted occupational deferment, the draft director said that these jobs include essential war industries and those which support the war effort by providing food, clothing, shelter, health, safety, or other requisites of daily life. Washington officials view the general's order as putting an end to the deferment of so-called necessary men in non-essential industries. And here's a reminder. Tomorrow is the day when the temporary ceilings on gasoline prices go into effect. The new price limits will affect 19 states and the District of Columbia. Prices to the consumer will be frozen at the March 13th levels, and filling station operators must display the price of each grade of gasoline sold in letters at least 5 inches tall. The order will remain in effect for 60 days and applies to all states on the Eastern Seaboard, the District of Columbia, and Washington and Oregon on the Pacific Coast. And so for the moment, that's the news from Washington.
These have been on-the-spot reports by Martin Agronsky from Melbourne, Australia, and John McVane from London. News from other fronts has been reported from Washington and New York. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.